Contemporary Music Centre podcast for September 2007. Composer of the Month, Pierce Halliwell, Part 2. In Part 2, Pierce speaks of his compositional style, methods and aspirations.
Are you deliberately an intentionally subversive composer? Mm. Or would you recognise that description of yourself?
Yeah, I would be honoured. I don't think I sound subversive, but I mean, subversion sounds so kind of conventional nowadays that I don't think that sounding subversive would be subversive. Yes, I think I am. I think I like to kind of balance the subversion of what you start out with, the history, the background, and also some very obvious kind of making use of it where it'll work. I mean, you know, everybody would like to claim that they're frightfully rebellious and kind of on the edge, but, you know, that's ludicrous for most of us to claim that. I actually think you can't compose in a vacuum, that you have to process where you've come from, and new things can feed in, and, you know, you can make use of them. But I think that we're all actually, working out of what we know, and I think that subversion isn't very... I don't think it's something that you can take on consciously.
Do you compose for the sake of it, because the idea has come to you unbidden and needs to be written down, or because there's a technical problem that you want to work through or try to solve, or do you need some other trigger or provocation?
I think the last. Yeah, neither of the first things. Not, I mean, it would be wonderful to be the kind of intuitive composer where you kind of just have to get on with it. But actually, I don't write a great deal, and I don't write at all fluently. I don't think I ever have. And I'm always amazed when I see a list with lots of pieces on it and think, you know, some of which shouldn't be, maybe, but, you know, I'm always surprised. I don't think it's the second thing that you mentioned either, the sort of exegesis of technical things. In fact, quite the reverse. I mean, I seem to be becoming more and more intuitive, where I really have no idea what's going on in what I'm writing. But I think it's something else. Maybe it's more abstract than that. It's just the desire, you know, given the opportunity of an ensemble or whatever, to try to produce something that works and that doesn't do what every other piece of work does. Because what I really like is actually collaborating with performers. I don't really see the point of it unless people play it.
How does who you work for affect, or write for, sorry, affect the way that you compose? And how involved are they in the process of composition?
It affects it in that it makes it feel worth doing. I have the feeling when I'm working away that there is an occasion. I mean, even if it's only a first performance, obviously you want multiple performances, but you think of one. If I can't think of one, I find it quite hard. You know, I have experience of writing pieces where I have to write it at a time where there is still an element of vagueness as to the when and where, you know. And obviously, for other reasons, you decide, you know, you're going to do it and you get into it. But once you're into it, it's got to happen. Yeah.
I've read that you've said in the past that composition found you rather than you finding it. Where's the kind of accuracy in that? And tell me about that moment or that period in your life when that happened.
Well, it's too long ago. I mean, I was kind of 5 years old. I can't really remember. I mean, I was never really going to be able to do anything else. And just... for my earliest memories, ordering sounds was kind of what I did. And, you know, before I had any idea about how to go about this, it just always seemed to me the only thing, you know, to do.
But how did you acquire a compositional vocabulary? I mean, was there any kind of consciousness that that's what you were doing, or was it simply a question of learning by doing?
I'm still acquiring it. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm very kind of restless, and I think the acquiring of vocabulary... That's a very good phrase, because I think that is actually a bit of a sweet thing. I think it's not necessarily a good thing. I mean, I'm very definitely not the kind of composer who, I hope, who has established a kind of way that pieces happen and how they end up, and then you just kind of wind him up and off he goes, or she goes. You know, I'm not that kind of composer. I'm extremely restless with what comes out, and you know, I'm fairly appalled by a lot of what I've written. And of course, you know, worse than being appalled by what you've written is admiring it in the past. I mean, you know, when people, you know, tremendously admire pieces from 15 years ago, and you go back to them and you admire them, you know, every composer past the age of, say, 40, with a kind of sustained back catalogue, faces this, that if you have any early successes, it's very, very hard, because what do you do then? And I know a lot of composers out there will recognise this and say, yes, unfortunately, that is true.
Do you think that's a response to having discovered very early on that you wanted to be a composer, and trying to, whether you were able to articulate this or not, but trying to avoid creating your own template too soon?
Yeah, well, all I can remember is wanting to create it when I was younger, actually. I think it's a process of maturing rather than that, because, I mean, I remember that, you know, going back to, you know, childhood composition and embarrassing kind of pastiches and things. I remember, you know, kind of working through the canon. You know, you learn a trio sonata on your instrument, so then you write one of those, and then you learn a classical sonata, so you write one of those, and then of course you hit kind of late romanticism, and you need to have a very sophisticated harmonic vocabulary, which I certainly didn't have, and so, you know, you kind of dry up, and all that was kind of, it was quite natural to me that was how you did it. You kind of worked through. So, you know, when I was 8, I wrote trio sonatas. When I was 11 or 12, I wrote kind of late 18th century. You know, when I was 15, I was kind of got up to kind of Delius or something. You know, you kind of work through. But I mean, in terms of you know, adult stuff, I actually think that actually formulating a kind of language for a young composer is the biggest thing there is. I mean, with my own students who troop into this room, you know, week after week, you know, that's what I'm looking for, and in a way, that's what they're looking for. And I mean, you always know, you know, there are people out there on CMC website whom I taught, and you know, I can see what they're doing now can be related to what they did the first week of their first year.
The notion of place is, seems to me to be very important to you, because the geographical location, the physical and emotional landscape of the world seems to play a significant part in your music.
Yes, I think that's very true. A very, very strong, unlooked for sense of place, so that, you know, when I hear things on the radio, I kind of remember where I last heard them, that kind of thing. And everything is kind of tied down in a terrible kind of clawing network of references like that. I think that landscape is just a very useful metaphor for how music works. I mean, language is another one, but it's very complicated for reasons we know to employ that one. Place is very good because none of us sees the same location in the same way. And the landscape with nobody in it can lie dormant until it's visited, and you know, in various ways like that.
And yet it is changing.
And yet it can change. I think it works very well for music, actually. Yes, yes, it does. I'm not very keen on a more romantic kind of, you know, kind of saying this is a piece about place X, that kind of thing. Although occasionally there are things in my own pieces which have direct, you know, very physical links to them, but
it's never directly pictorial. It's not.
No, hardly ever.
And that approach, and the repeated use of the title "Sound Carvings" for some of your works. Does that? I mean, can we infer from that that you think that music is something to be unlocked or released or prized away from the physical world, albeit perhaps not absolutely literally so.
Yes, I think it is. I think that's a good description. I mean, I often think in terms of sculpture, of you know, the shape inside the block of wood or stone that's kind of, you know, most of us couldn't release, and that the sculptor kind of discovers. And I think that's very true. You know, you've got your four instruments in the string quartet, and the composer has to come up with something interesting and of kind of sufficient worth and validity. Actually, the sound carvings title came something a bit more specifically natural than that. It came from a concern with narrative form, with the shape in which pieces of music are, which I mentioned earlier. It came from looking at rock patterns of a particular kind, of the sort that, for example, we've used a lot on the CDs I mentioned, and looking at the lichens that cover these rock patterns, which I photographed, and it was the idea of a basically impassive surface of rock, let's say it's grey, it isn't always grey, with these splodges of what I think is actually sort of a living organism on them. And in 1988, I took this as the title for a first piece and then a series, because it suggested to me the idea of sound against a background of silence, and I was interested in multiple movement forms and thought I was going to be interested in them. And in the same way as you might have a surface of rock with two big splodges on it, that would suggest one form, kind of two movements, as it were, against a background. Or you might have lots and lots of little ones, which actually was what I did in the first sound carvings. You know, it just seemed to me that there was a parallel for me in my sort of searching for how to make the narrative of a work sort of be flexible and stand up. There was a parallel between that and these natural occurrences of kind of bursts of colour against a grey background.
Has the experience of parenthood changed the way you compose?
Changed the amount I compose? No, actually, I'm quite hermetic about that. I think it's a kind of, I mean, there certainly isn't a literal green baize door, but I think that they're far from it. Although, you know, some composers seem to manage that. It's not that. You know, I think what music gives me is the fact that it doesn't relate to all that. Because music is not concrete or conceptual in terms of what it says, people always want it explained, and they always want it explained in terms of something else, in terms of words and feelings and things, whereas the whole point to me is that you are erecting this kind of edifice in its own dimensions. It doesn't need any of that.
Even though it's in kind of intensely emotional and a very direct response to something, it's essentially not autobiographical.
Not at all, no. No, I mean, I'm just trying to... I mean, I think in that sense I'm quite clinical, maybe scientific, definitely not in any other way, that I'm just trying to kind of organise sounds in terms of a kind of syntax that makes sense. You know, I mean, one is a kind of... It's a sort of attempt at being a kind of magician to organise something which balances two basically irreconcilable things, which is to make sense by means of repetition, and at the same time to renew its own ability to express by not being predictable.
Contemporary Music Centre podcast series. For more information, audio and video, log on to www.cmc.ie.